Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. Now, what does it mean to be the conscience of psychiatry? It means that in some circles you're extremely unpopular, and in other circles, very popular. The folks I have on my radio show are generally among the circles that I'm popular in. Today's no exception. My guest today is Timothy Evans, Timothy D. Evans. I met Tim recently when I spoke at the Florida Adlerian Society. Tim is very active in the society, and he was, I believe, running the conference. And I met his wife, Jerry. And I really, really like these people. I won't tell you what Adlerians are. I'm going to leave that to Tim. But I read a lot of Adler when I was in college, and I think it's had a profound influence on me. By the way, I read it on my own, not assigned at Harvard. And I think it had a very profound influence on me because there's very little in substance in any difference of opinion between me and the Adlerians in general. And I believe that if Alfred Adler were alive today, he'd opposed the drugging of human beings, and especially children, the human beings he most cared about. I think he would really not believe in drugging them. Tim is a PhD, and he has worked in counseling psychology. Counselors are often among the most open-minded and caring of our professional colleagues. He works in marriage and family therapy, where he's licensed in Florida. Now, this I'd like him to explain to us. He's a Torrance Creative Scholar Mentor. He knows a lot of interesting people. He's worked with athletes. He's done a lot of speech making on encouragement and self-development. And working with the Florida Adlerian Society, he's had in very illustrious speakers. Robert Whittaker, who wrote Mad in America, my friend William Glasser, the choice theory guy. And then he's also had Peter Bragan, author of Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness, come to his conferences. I really, really want to welcome Tim to the show. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Peter. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, I'm delighted. Delighted. I had such a great time meeting you and your wife and just a whole bunch of other people in Florida, and I'm really hoping we'll be doing stuff together.
Well, I hope so, too. One thing about our group is we think it's important to have fun, and we promote good mental health, and having fun is an indicator. I think it's the lifeblood of good relationships. So you were fun to have down here, and you certainly fit in well with what we're trying to do in our local community and our belief about good mental health. So you fit in really well, and it was very inspiring to have you down here. I think people were very excited, and I know there were people in the audience that some of the people in the audience go all over the world to do workshops and training, and it was nice to see them taking in what you were saying and being enthusiastic. I know one fellow, Dr. Frank Walton, I think he's going to invite you to come to South Carolina to work with that local group. So it was really inspiring and helpful to have you here, and we're very grateful.
Well, that's wonderful. I enjoyed meeting Frank as well. I'm beginning more and more to see my role as encouraging groups to really embrace empathic therapy, which, of course, your group has already done, but to embrace it in a way that says, and that means we don't diagnose and drug. We don't do medication compliance anymore. We're not an arm of wicked psychiatric biological thinking. We really believe in what we're doing. And I hope I inspired some of your folks to say, you know, they're not going to keep their mouth shut anymore. They're going to say what they think to their clients. They're going to talk about anything. Psychiatric drugs isn't going to be off the table to talk about. So I hope I'm just going to give courage to the non-medical people.
Well, it certainly was. You certainly did give me courage to do that. I think Jerry and I, we see a fair amount of people. I mean, we're booked every day. And I was originally trained by Carl Rogers out in California, and he was somebody who was very much interested in empathy, warmth, and genuineness, and not being judgmental. I'm not sure if I'd even be in the profession today, because today it's so different. I think people come in and you're trained to diagnose them and to find out what's wrong with them and to look at their shortcoming and then put them on medication. And that's so against what I was originally trained. It was so against the whole purpose of getting into the profession to help people. I'm just sure people like Rogers would be rolling over in their grave if they knew the training was to look at somebody's shortcomings and then put them into a manual full of unhappy people. And I think after the workshop, I was more willing to speak up and not be so hesitant to talk to people about their drug medication. I was doing it, but not to the extent I am now. And I think we find that the majority of people don't want to be on drugs, because it's almost, if they're on drugs, they're admitting that there's something wrong with their brain. So it was very inspiring to have you come in, and it certainly has changed the way I'm approaching doing the therapy.
Well, I couldn't ask for more, Tim. I mean, you're a wonderful person, you and your wife, and so many of the people I met down there are just warm, caring, very skilled clinicians, very thoughtful people. And I just want to help liberate all of you from the yoke of obedience to psychiatry. How about that for a new phrase? The yoke of obedience to psychiatry.
One of the Adlerians had written a book. That's interesting you said that. Beecher and Beecher wrote a book called The Sin of Obedience. That was the title of their book. And that falls right in line with what you're saying, that we're obedient, and that just creates a whole lot of problems when you're obedient to authority. And in particular, I think the authority is misguided.
Right on. You know, you gave me the tentative title for my new book proposal that I've sent out. I've been searching for a title for it, and it's about the long-range brain damage produced by psychiatric drugs, the long-term harm, people staying on them, millions and millions of people who are going to have trouble being themselves again after this exposure, and they really, really need to face it. Well, that book is out there circulating to publishers, and goodness knows what response we're going to get. But you know what? I'm not going to give away that secret title. I think it'll just allow the drug companies to get in there even faster to go after it. But you came up with it just talking casually from the audience, and I'm grateful for that. I'd be happy to have you talk about anything you want, including Alfred Adler, or just how you think of therapy, either way.
Well, the Adlerian psychology is just such a hopeful view of human nature. When I first ran into my first Adlerian, I was in graduate school, and I was working with offenders in the inner city, and I was really lost. The training I'd had didn't prepare me at all for working with guys in the penitentiary. And I got a hold of a teacher named Cameron Meredith, and he was using all these words like encouragement and talking about purposive behavior, and that we use our symptoms to suit a purpose and the goals of misbehavior. And I started experimenting what I was hearing, what he was saying about that may not have been such a good idea, because I was just flying by the seat of my pants trying to help these guys. But it was effective, and that just caught my attention. And from there, I went out to, I already had a graduate degree, and I went out to, I was in Washington, D.C., and I started working with heroin addicts, and I started taking courses at Bowie State, and they were Adlerian courses. And I fell in love with an ideal or a concept. And Adler was an interesting guy because he was for the ordinary man. He was for the common man, and he thought that psychology should be given away, and it's a different type of thinking. Like, it didn't look at cause and effect, like the past causes the present, or there's some chemical imbalance that's causing you to misbehave. But he talked about behavior being purposive. That's probably one of the hardest ideas, is that our behavior serves a purpose, and you have to change the way you think. But the other idea he had was this idea of social interest. And social interest really is the golden rule. It's about, really comes down to being a good citizen. It comes down to having an interest in your fellow human beings. There's very few psychologies that talk much about being a good citizen, having an interest in others. And I think your empathy therapy, though, because empathy is, it fits our idea of social interest. It fits in order to be empathic. Adler said you had to see what through the other person's eyes, hear with the other person's ears, and feel with the other person's heart to be connected to them. And that fit also well with Carl Rogers and all the third force psychology that I was studying. And I think the big thing, though, Peter, what you helped me with at that conference, with all these brain drugs that people are taking, it shuts down those frontal lobes. And when we shut down those frontal lobes, people can't connect. They can't be empathic. They can't love. And that's how they got themselves in trouble in the first place. All the kids we have coming into our office diagnosed with ADHD and attention deficit, if you just simply ask them, who'd you help today? Lots of times they'll say, help, I can't help anybody, don't you know I have a disorder? And it never occurred to me, and that was so helpful in our conference when you talked about how those brain medications stop those frontal lobes from connecting with other people. And that also includes the adults we have coming in here with marital problems. Once they get on that brain medication, it seems like we're working against ourselves because we're trying to get them to connect more. And the more they connect, the happier they are. And the less they connect, the less happier they are. But the medication in and of itself maintains the problem. So, but Adlerian psychology is just a very hopeful psychology. It's a humanistic psychology. Sometimes Adlerians get accused of being a cult. We're not in a cult. But it certainly is a commitment to living your life in terms of having an interest to others.
Yeah, that I had just no trouble at all having that word social interest flow out of my lungs when I was talking to your group, because it's so much what I believe. I tend to talk about just flat out love and caring, and doing it in an empathic way, which means you really seek to understand and to know what the other person feels, not what you imagine or want them to feel. And it's just totally consistent with everything I read in Adler. And I suspect that Adler had much more influence on me than I thought when I was reading as a youngster, because I read the big Ansbarger and Ansbarger book, studied it and underlined it. And that's, as you know, but for my audience, Selections from Alfred Adler by Ansbarger and Ansbarger. And I've read several of his books as well. Now, at the heart of Adlerian approach is that we're all human beings who want to be relating to each other and who want to do good, if I understand correctly, that we basically not only are social, but it's not just a herd. We really, really want to do good. And when that gets twisted around because of injuries and humiliations and so on, then we give up relating through being good and caring and contributing. We go for power. Is that a good summary?
That's a good summary. When we think we all have this desire to belong, and we think we're entitled to our birthright. It's not something you have to earn. It's just a given that human beings are good enough the way they are, which is sort of counter to current education. And so much of what we get nowadays is you have to, growth and improvement come through dissatisfaction with oneself. And Adlerians are thinking that human beings are good enough as they are, and if you can free people to recognize their place, they'll be encouraged, and the more encouraged they are, the more they contribute and the more they connect. But when when people misperceive their place, are we prevent people from having a sense of belonging? One way that we prevent people from having a sense of belonging is through failure and rewards and punishment. That when people get discouraged, they're going to try to find their place through useless means. They're going to attempt to fit in and belong through misbehavior. But overall, I think Adlerians have this idea that human beings have this desire, this innate desire to belong and to move towards growth. I always looked at it as I grew up in the Midwest and out on the farms, and we'd have cellars. And if you've ever been in a cellar in the Midwest, it's usually they keep it black and they block the windows so critters can't fall down in there and get trapped in snow. But there's always a ray of sunlight sort of coming through into the cellar. It sneaks in somehow. You'll just see a stream of light. And what always amazed me is the potatoes would have roots. They sprout roots growing towards that sunlight. And so even in all that darkness and down in that damp cellar, those potatoes had this desire to move towards the sunlight and for growth. Well, I've worked with a lot of discouraged people and a lot of unhappy people and a lot of people that other folks have given up on. But I always had this belief that we all have this potential to move to the useful side, to be a part of things. And I know it sounds kind of corny, but to move towards that sunlight, like those potatoes sprouting those roots, I just so often it seems like when we start medicating people, we've given up on them, and we're sort of like it's the last resort. And it just goes so against our DNA programming to move towards growth, to move towards development, to move towards each other. I think as human beings, we want to connect.
Well, I'm just with you 100%. One of the things that I've struggled with and changed my mind about many times over the years, but I'm not sure it matters as much as I think, is this issue of, are we inherently good and eager to move toward the sunlight, or are we a mixed bag? Are we more like a mixture of good and evil, the way the Judeo-Christian viewpoint is, or Reinhold Niebuhr, that we have this capacity to be terribly destructive, and we have to be able to recognize that in others and in ourselves, and encourage in ourselves that more positive side? I don't think Adler thought a lot about that, did he?
No, there's not this duality in us where you've got the angel on your right hand and the devil on your left hand.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're at odds with each other. We don't think that way. We don't think that there's this duality in human beings. We're very holistic. We think that your thinking and your behavior and your feeling and your physiology is all one movement. And you can't think without a feeling, you can't feel without a behavior, and you can't think without a physiological component to it, and that they're all in sync. They're working harmoniously together towards a goal. We're a goal-oriented theory that human beings move in a direction. We organize ourselves to move towards a goal. We're not pushed by it from the past, but we're pulled by the future and how we perceive how we're going to make our place, how we perceive we're going to have a plus. So there's not this duality between good and evil. And I'm glad you clarified that, because that's not what I was trying to say. So that's good clarity.
Yeah, and I think where what I was thinking is where it may sound naive is where we come to grips with that, how often human beings are evil and destructive. But I don't think that requires a belief in the duality. I mean, there's just plenty of roadblocks in life to the human beings developing as they naturally would with the proper encouragement and social relationship, which is so often missing. And I don't know that I have the answer. It just struck me like it was worth looking at that bit of complexity. And, of course, Freud, from whom Adler broke, I hadn't thought about it to this moment, but Freud, from whom Adler broke, really did have a concept of the inherent destructiveness in human beings that also struggled with the inherent more positive aspect, which he thought of as sex. I mean, he didn't even have a spiritual concept at all, Freud. I can see why Adler would have let go of that pretty quickly. But there's that duality in Freud between the life forces, which he pretty much concretized as sex, and the death forces, all of which he thought struggled in us, in our id. And there's just such a clearer vision of the positive human being and human nature in Adler, and there isn't all this weird stuff that comes with so many other psychologies. Adler originally thought in terms of the inferiority complex being inherent in human beings, as I remember. And did he let go of that and decide there wasn't anything really inherent about struggling with your inferiority complex?
Yes, that's a good question. His theory probably evolved three times. And when he was very upset that people thought, and I'm glad you said he broke from Freud, because people often call him as being a student of Freud. He wasn't a student of Freud. Freud invited Adler to join the group. In fact, Adler used to carry a little postcard around showing that I was invited to the group. I wasn't a student of Freud. But he did... He did break away from the idea that we're, you know, like the whole idea that we're just small pebbles of sand and there's this big universe and we're compensating for our inferiority and we're always striving for superiority. His third evolution with this theory was the idea that, and this was the social interest idea, that no, human beings aren't striving to compensate for their feelings of inferiority. They're more compensating to, but they have this desire to connect. And human beings are highly cooperative. And our survival as human beings depends on our ability to cooperate and be good citizens and have an interest in each other. So he sort of moved beyond the inferior and superior notion and got into the social interest notion that we need to be each other's brothers and sisters, to be each other's, to have an interest in your fellow human being, which is really the golden rule.
It is. It's absolutely the golden rule. It's the best of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and it's the best of pretty much all religious traditions, which have some variation on the golden rule. And I love it. I just feel very, very at home. I can tell folks that if you go to an Adlerian conference, you'll get a feeling very similar to going to our empathic therapy conference, which, let me remind everybody, is April 13th through 15th. It's coming up. You need to sign up. April 13th through the 15th, the empathic therapy conference in Syracuse, New York. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, half day on Sunday. You can meet me, and you can meet my students who will be coming. They're not students of Brigham. They're students at the SUNY Oswego Department of Counseling in the graduate school. They come as a part of their class. But mainly you'll meet a couple of hundred people from around the world. And the common theme of empathic therapy doesn't mean Bregan therapy. I'd call it Breganini therapy, I guess, or something like that, if I had my own special therapy. The empathic therapy includes Adlerian therapy, from my concept and my wife's concept. Empathic therapy is an overview. So you won't see people saying, well, I'm a Bregan clone. No one's going to say that. People are going to be under this umbrella of caring, thoughtful approaches. Now, the one difference from an Adlerian conference, somewhat, although that's changing, when you have somebody like Whitaker and me come, is we're going to be also showing the dark side of psychiatry and how it interferes with empathic therapy. So April 13th through 15th, come on to Syracuse, New York. You can learn about it just by going to my website, Bregin.com, Bregin, and then search around for the conference, or go right to the conference, empathictherapy.org. And one of the things I'm just thinking about talking with Tim is, and that I talked about with his group, is that when you look at the fundamental issue as social interest or love or social relationship, human relationship, becomes so easy to understand the more despairing approaches. If you look at quote bipolar disorder, what are you looking at, if to the extent it exists? Mostly it's a fake diagnosis and mostly it's a drug induced, but there are people who get high and manic and euphoric on themselves. And what are they doing? Well, they've left social connection and they're seeking a more grandiose way of feeling better about themselves. And of course that doesn't work. So then they may sink back into a depressive and giving up view. So they'll go from superpower to giving up and being depressed. But the issue for them is to learn normal social relating. The issue for all of us is learning productive, creative, caring ways of relating. And psychosis in general, I see as nothing more than the shredding, the destruction of social relationships, social interest, caring, by humiliation and other kinds of trauma. And I really enjoy, if you want to have a good time, go to an Adlerian conference. Tim is right. There's a lot of emphasis on caring and on enjoying each other and on having fun. Very different than going to a psychiatric conference where everyone looks depressed, as perhaps they should be, given how they're treating other human beings. Tim, we've got about a minute or two before the break. Say a little more about your work and where you are, and then we'll take a break and come back again. Well, maybe you could talk some about your clinical work.
One thing I want to say, Peter, is we really need to join up with you. We're very excited that you have this conference in New York. And I know at our next board meeting, we've got to figure out how to unite the different groups together to have a stronger impact, because I think there are a lot of fragmented people out there that are thinking this way, but we have to have some type of organization to be supportive of others and support clinicians and also support the public, because so many people come into our office and they're coerced into treatments, they're coerced into medication, they're coerced into forcing their kids to take the medication, and there needs to be a support system out there and a respectful quality support system that says, hey, there's a different way to do this, and it's effective too. And I couldn't agree with you more about what people need help is figuring out how to stay connected and relate better to others. And when we always have somebody come in there diagnosed with bipolar, we're going to ask what the purpose of the bipolar is. And again, we're back to purpose of behavior. And we'll always look for where there's a disconnection in an important relationship. And when people have disconnections in important relationships and it continues for a while and they don't have the information to know how to connect, they're going to be symptomatic. And the symptoms we'll agree with, but the diagnosis that there's something wrong with their brain or they've got chemical imbalances, that's where we'll begin to disagree with them. We'll start wanting to educate. We're about educating people on how to connect better. And we're really, it's what we're really interested in, I think what you're talking about too, is helping people be happy individuals, happy people who are well connected. I don't think you could find any people who are happy and well connected on any brain medications. I've been looking for them and I haven't been able to find
right.
them.
Right, they're
not
right.
existent.
Listen, you're listening
that
to my friend.
Tim,
let me cut off now and go to break.
Sure.
But you're listening to my dear friend, really a dear friend already, Timothy Evans from Tampa, Florida. He has a private practice. When we come back, let's talk about purposiveness and goals and striving, because it's the nature of human beings.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I'm talking with Tim Evans from Tampa, Florida. Tim, how do people get in touch with you?
We have a website. It's a really informative website. You can find articles, and we have video clips, and you could go to our website, and that website is carterandevans.com, and is spelled out, so it's carterandevans.com. That's our last names.
Okay, let's talk more about purposiveness, goal-seeking behavior. I haven't talked enough about this on the air, and yet it's in my bones, in my heart, and in how I practice. Academic psychology tends to view the human being pretty much in kinds of inanimate terms. And in nature, we no longer think of trees striving to grow, although I think maybe they do. We think that the trees are growing because of the mechanics of chlorophyll and whatever other hugely complex things make those little potatoes you were talking about, Tim, reach toward the light. We don't think that way about human beings. We don't even imagine metaphorically reaching toward the light. And the people who come to see us for help, by and large, have to one degree or another given up on fulfilling their purposes. They may not even anymore think in terms of purposes. They're thinking of getting over being depressed. They don't think of what purposes I've failed to achieve that have left me feeling this way. So I'd like to talk more about that and maybe how you deal with it in an actual clinical practice.
Well, that's a good topic, Peter, and you've taken on one of the hardest things to help people wrap their brains around, even training graduate students, getting them to think of behavior as purposive. They have to see the world in a different way. It's almost like learning a different language because they're so trained in cause and effect psychology and looking for causes instead of looking at human beings have this tremendous capacity to make choices and to make decisions on how they're going to interpret things and how they're going to respond to a situation. And so on the larger aspect, there's this striving for meaning in life, to have significance, to know we count, to know that we're important. And that certainly is an important aspect of it. And then we also will look at maybe the immediate purposiveness. You mentioned bipolar, and that's the big diagnosis nowadays. If somebody comes in and say they're bipolar, we're going to think, what purpose does that symptom serve them in relationship to another human being? Now, you have to go really slow with that, because when you ask somebody, what's the purpose of sleeping all day, or what's the purpose of depressing, they're going to look at you kind of strange, thinking, well, I don't cause that. This is out of my control. And it's a hard thing to wrap your brain around, but we think people make choices, and they even make choices of their symptoms. I had a lady in her late 20s come in, and she was really spellbound. That's such a good idea you have with being bipolar. They had convinced her all her life that she was bipolar, and she was talking about her, it was in her family, everyone in her family was bipolar, and they had her on medication. And she had happened to, she'd gotten married, she was in her late 20s, and she had a baby. So the whole time during her pregnancy, she came off the medication. And of course, now she was back in my office, somebody told her about me, and she was convinced that she was bipolar, and she was wanting to consider getting back on this medication, because she had no control over her behavior, and it was just a chemical imbalance. Well, with that, you'd want to look at the purpose of her behavior, and it's sort of hard, because people are guarded, and rightly so, and they don't know who you are. But if you can get them talking to you about an unsatisfying relationship, and you can do it with somebody who's caring and empathic. So often when people start talking about an unsatisfying relationship, they think you're going to criticize them or find something wrong. But if you stick with it to say, hey, I'm here to help you improve that unsatisfying relationship, then sometimes they're willing to talk to you. And the more she talked, the more it became clear that when she chose to do her depressing, it had to do with her relationship with her husband. Here she was with a new baby, new marriage, working full time, and then she was taking on all the responsibility of the house, the kid, her husband. And so as it turned out, the days she was depressing were the days her husband was out having a good time and not there at home helping her out with the baby and the kids and making sure she was okay. Now, that sounds rather simplistic, and that's probably the biggest challenge we have, is when you start talking to people about their purposiveness and what they're up to, they'll start looking at you like it's too simplistic. And that's one of our biggest challenges, is even though it sounds simplistic, this is challenging to stay connected and to solve this problem with your husband. That becomes hard. So I don't know if that's a good demonstration, but maybe that could stimulate some discussion about purposive
it's
behavior.
It's a good demonstration. I'm of two minds about it. I know that I actually see this in myself. For example, recently there was a really vicious attack on me by very big-time lawyers, because I'm mounting quite an attack on their clients, who happened in this case to be the government of Canada, I believe, or something close to that, over an issue of treatment of the elderly with drugs. And this attack was very misleading and upsetting. And for a couple of days, I think I actually almost decided I'd rather be depressed than deal with this. I mean, that's one way to look at it. And then finally, I decided to deal with it. And one way I dealt with it was by admitting what was so painful to me, telling my wife, Ginger, enlisting her help, and becoming the social team that we do all the time. We're just always a team in all the work we do. But I dropped out of the team because I felt so hurt by this. And it took me a while to just get back to myself and instead of being withdrawn and injured, to decide I don't want to be that way, I want to be the other way. So that's a real, I think, that's kind of a perfect example of what you're saying, right?
There's no doubt about it. A good therapist, I think one of our jobs in therapy is to point out what people's intents are. You have your good intentions, and then you have your real intentions. And by the time we're adults, we have been socialized, and there's no way we can just be that aware of ourselves to let somebody know what our real intention is. And so, and I think it was interesting you picked up on what your intent is, because we always talk about the choice to depress. It's kind of like a protest or a sit-down strike. When people are choosing to press, they're really protesting a situation, or they're, you could picture them sitting out in the middle of the road with a sign held up high like, this is unfair, this shouldn't be happening to me, and it's a little bit of a vacation. But it's interesting how you picked up on your intent of that, and Adlerians always call that spitting in one's soup. When you point out the intention of what somebody's up to, they may still go ahead and do it, but it's a little bit harder to do it because they're usually thinking about you. And that's probably what good therapy is a therapist that kind of gets into your brain, and when you're misbehaving, you're thinking about the therapist and what it is you're up to.
Now, the other side of it, having said what I said, which really fits in with the Adlerian approach, when I think about, for example, the person who comes in who is in a depression, 55, 60-year-old man, let's say, he is in just a wretched depression. He looks dark. You look at him, you could see the cloud over him, like the little sandstorm over the character in the Snoopy cartoons.
Right.
You feel it. It's there. He's not able to think straight. He's not able to care. He's not motivated. He probably only came because somebody else dragged him in. It's very hard to think of that man as choosing to be the way he is. And, of course, he's going to resent being the way, being told that he's choosing it. And I tend to think of it in two different ways. One is that he's chosen it. The other is that the choices are made bit by bit by bit, so the person doesn't even realize what they've dug themselves into. So first there's a choice not to tell your wife you want more love. Then there's a choice not to tell your boss you feel you need a raise. Then there's a choice not to think about what you really want out of life because you'll never get it. And then you get the choice on choice, and by the time you get to the place of depression, this dark, awful, horrible place that nobody feels they want to be in or believes they want to be in, the path of choice is gone. And then I have yet another way of thinking about it, and I want to just look at some of the complexity, and that is that it's not a choice at all to get that depressed. It's sort of a default position. What you're choosing is not to face the shame, the humiliation of making other choices, of deciding you want more, of deciding you want to contribute, deciding you want a good life, deciding you want to love, and so on. So you fall into the default when you fail to pursue the good choices. So I tend to kind of feel with my client, my patient, you know, where are you coming from with all of this? And not to make it too straight and narrow, but boy, it's real similar to what you're saying. So just your thoughts on that, Tim.
Well, I think you helped me with somebody that came in here last week with that description. Because it almost sounds like you're talking about a fellow I had in there last week, especially with the age range. And you know, I'm very respectful of people, and I really care about people to the extent that sometimes they don't get it, because we're really not out for a cup of coffee. And one thing I want everybody in this office to be doing is first-rate therapy, which means we're not here as bobbleheads just to agree with what someone's saying. And I just like what you said you almost described this guy I had in here last week, and he was drug in here. He didn't want to be in here. They had canceled the appointment twice that day, and they showed up anyway. And you really have to say some things that you wouldn't normally say to somebody if you met them out in public. And it's a little bit risky to talk to some people this way, particularly if they're already discouraged and they're already feeling down. But I sometimes feel like I'm only going to have one shot at this, and let me see what I can do to make a difference. And that part, I think, about somebody wanting more love and they're at a certain age, all those descriptors you said fit. And sometimes you just don't know. This is really an art. It was interesting. After I finished the session, I didn't know if I had gotten through to this guy, because I was really talking to him about how much people loved him, and that there were some people in the room that probably loved him more than anybody on the planet, and these were the most significant people in his life. And he'd never seen a therapist before, and it was almost like a failure coming in to see somebody as a therapist. When I have these men that age that start thinking about their failure to come in to see me, I always whip out the athletes that I have come in to see me to talk about. It's good mental health to go talk to somebody just like you would a dentist if you had a bad tooth. But I really didn't know where I had left this guy. And I don't know if you have this feeling, but sometimes you just know you could make improve things for people if they were just open. But you're dealing with the factor of human beings, and I certainly don't want to be coercive, and I certainly don't want to force somebody to see it my way, to become dogmatic. And I didn't think I'd help this guy at all. And the next day, I had emailed the person that brought him in, just trying to be encouraging to her and tell her that she could still make changes and still work with this man. And she emailed me back, and she said they went out to get coffee, and while they were having coffee, her husband sat there and said, "That guy really understands me. That guy really gets me." And that was such a compliment, but at the time, I didn't think I was doing anything to reach him. But those are, I'd have to agree with you, that the two approaches and those dynamics exist. And what you said was helpful to me, too. I think talking to him about wanting more love, that would be a useful conversation with him. And, Peter, you've seen me, so it's a little bit easier for me to talk to guys about wanting more love, because I was a freestyle wrestler, and it looks like I've been in a fight or two. So I sort of make it more acceptable for two men to be sitting here talking about loving each other.
Yeah. Well, as a not very large human being growing up, I learned to project, I think, a big largeness, so that I pretty much get along with those big guys, too, although some of them are shocked when I stand up beside them. It's really interesting, though, how often big people don't know they're big physically, because they don't feel big personally. And on a number of occasions at 5'4", I've stood up with somebody who's 6'4" and said, "Look how big you are. You need to know that you're imposing. You need to know that if you're gentle, people will be grateful. You're like the big bear, that people are so happy when they can touch your paw safely," and talk to them about just the gift of their size in terms of using it, knowing that they can be gentle and peaceful. And it's sometimes very, very hard for these big, strong men to understand that part of themselves and how they can use it. And I'm sure Adlerians would have a good insight into that, because it's a kind of an Adlerian issue. Tim, is there anything you'd like to specifically bring up and talk about? I mean, we can, you know, I'm happy with how we're going, but we've got only about 6-7 minutes left, and I want to make real sure that But you get to talk about everything you want to talk about.
Well, the one thing I would say, Peter, that I think we're in sync with is making mental health a public health issue. I think informing the public of what is good mental health. I think if you ask most citizens what does it mean to be physically fit, everybody can give you the criteria for being physically fit, like you exercise more and you eat less. But if I go into a graduate class, and these are people studying to become therapists, and I say, what does it mean to be mentally fit? What does a healthy person look like? They just stare at me with blank stares. They get a lot of courses and what does it mean to be abnormal and DSM-5, but they have no clue of what a healthy person looks like. And I think Abraham Maslow said, if you only study sick people, you end up with a sick psychology. And I think the thing that's inspiring about you is, and what we've been talking about for the past hour, is what is good mental health? What do good human relationships look like? And I think we need to inform the public. My dad was a college professor, and I remember as a kid going into his class, and everybody would be smoking cigarettes, and the whole room would be full of smoke. And nobody thought anything about it, but we made smoking a public health issue, and we educated the public. My hope is that we make mental health a public health issue, and I'm hoping within future time, when people look back on all the medication we're dispensing, that they'll look at that as bad as smoking three packs of cigarettes a day, that we can inform the public and the common man to know this is good mental health, this is bad mental health, these are the things you do to stay connected and be happy and practice good mental health, and these are the things you don't want to do to practice bad mental health, and that includes all the drugs we're dispensing.
Do you want to say a few more words about your vision and Adler's vision of a healthy, happy human being? What does that look like?
I think these healthy, happy human beings are people who function and they contribute, and we get off of this whole notion about being exceptional, fantastic, and best, that just by whatever we can contribute and function and be connected to the important people in our lives, our spouses and our kids, that there's a paradigm, and have acceptance and know that this is an enjoyable way to go through life. So much of what we get is the competitiveness, striving to be exceptional, striving to be outstanding. If you're not exceptional and outstanding, then you aren't very worthwhile. And we try to convince people that you're good enough the way you are. Being an ordinary person is something that's extraordinary. I think in Sweden they have a term called lagom, and the word lagom means whatever you do is enough. And we have a sense that when we see people over here that they need to do better, to be more outstanding. And when they make those statements, they're already conveying to us that they don't accept themselves the way they are. So if you have self-acceptance, which means you believe you're good enough as you are, then you're free to go out there and contribute and have good relationships.
I like that. You know, when I see children with their parents in particular, it becomes so absolutely clear the distortions that are going on. You know, and most of these parents in the group I deal with, they're pretty sophisticated, so they've done the worst of everything, because that's what psychiatry is, and they'll come in with a whole battery of neuropsychological testing on their child, and right in front of the kid they'll be explaining his executive functions are impaired, he's got some dyslexia, and on and on. And I'll pick up the report, and I'll look at the parents. If the kid's there, I'll give the child a big smile, and I'll say, well, I noticed this report about little Jimmy doesn't begin with this wonderful youngster with such a sweet smile, who is just really a joy to be with. I just commend the parents on how great he is, and keep on helping this boy just enjoy himself the way he is. It never begins that way, and it never ends that way. I think three times in my life I've read any kind of a note from a psychiatric professional, not other mental health, but a psychiatrist that began with this very enjoyable person or something like that. And I tell folks, listen, throw away this 20 pages of garbage about what's the matter with your son. That's not useful or meaningful. It doesn't matter. Or your daughter, it doesn't matter. Let's talk about your good stuff. And let's help you enjoy and grow with your good stuff.
Peter,
and it's a revelation to parents nowadays to not be thinking of the negatives of their kids, but to be thinking about their good stuff and how to help their kids have their good stuff. And a lot of it begins with just simple respect in the family. I mean, so key to all of this is the relationship in the family, whether it's children or adults, which is we start with really respecting each other, treating each other kindly, and then we go on to love each other. Tim, I'm going to finish up now. We've been talking with Tim Evans. Timothy, they can probably find you in the phone book, can't they, in Tampa, Florida?
Right, or you can go to www.carterandevans.com. That's our website. You can get our phone numbers, our email address. It's an interesting website, and we're going to put a link on there so people can link up with you, and that's a good way to contact us.
Thank you very much. And let me take now a minute and remind folks it's getting down to the wire. You want to come to a wonderful conference, April 13th to 15th, here in Syracuse, New York. Go to my website, BREGGIN.com, or go right to empathictherapy.org. You get to meet me and Ginger. You know, in my radio shows, I just talk a lot in a conversation, but I'm going to be doing a lot of direct presentations about what we believe in, and there's going to be marvelous people, Australia, Switzerland, from all over the world, talking about how to really live a good life, how to really help people, and how to stand up to biological psychiatry. See you April 13th through 15th.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's BREGGIN.com.